for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. There's nothing extraordinary about a misbehaving boy being sent to bed without supper. But when that boy's name is Max and he makes mischief of one kind or another, travels to a faraway land and is crowned king of all wild things, a simple tale of child rebellion and fantasy becomes a classic. Joining me in the studio for this month's Reader's Review of Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, child psychiatrist Judith Rappaport, Gregory McGuire. He's author of Making Mischief, a Maurice Sendak appreciation, and noted children's literature author, historian, and critic, Leonard Marcus. Now, I can only imagine how many of you have read Where the Wild Things Are, read it to yourselves, your children. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. Leonard, what did you think about the book, reading it again?
Well, it's really one of the perfect picture books. Everything, every small element of it comes together to make you feel what Max is going through and to be entertained and also touched. The pictures start out small and they get bigger and bigger, and Max, as Max's feelings get more and more out of control, and then you get to that middle part where words will not do and the wild things have their rumpus, and then it sort of goes back down to reality again. And there are a few picture books that really get a hold of a child's range, the arc of a child's feelings, and the way that does and translates it into words and pictures.
Gregory, why do you think the book has such extraordinary broad appeal?
Well, you can go at this book as a Jungian, as a Freudian, as a critic of art, as a critic of child psychology, as a person interested in the American ideal of self-actualization and of self-reliance. It's a really American picture book. It's downright Emersonian, I think.
Do you think it's just for children?
No. Indeed, I have to fight with my children over which is my copy and which is theirs. When you ask the question about how do you come to it now, what it makes me think of is I came to it as a kid about 10 or 12 when I was growing up, reading it to my younger brothers and sisters. But now I have kids of my own who are about the same age as my younger brothers and sisters were then, and I come to it both as an adult with my capacity to know something about heart history and about sequencing and pacing and page design, but I also come to it as a parent with my capacity to observe and to feel in my lap the shivers and the trembles and the tremors of excitement as my children explore a story for the first time. So I have the advantage, which is fun, to actually come to it two ways at the same time. It's very binocular.
And Judith Rappaport, as a child psychiatrist, how do you come to it?
Well, certainly a child psychiatrist with Maurice Sendak has no shortage of things to say. Most prominently would be that, speaking as both a parent and a child psychiatrist, there's possibly no child on earth that doesn't deal with anger and need for control. And as Gregory points out, children are a minority in a certain sense, that with a lot of big people controlling them. And so one of the messages from a psychiatric or psychological point of view is that not only does Sendak acknowledge that and allow it as part of his book, but thanks to the magnificent art, he almost magnificently celebrates it. The color and the joy of the art is more than permission. It's understanding for the child that he can with them revel in it because these are glorious paintings.
Well, they're figures of really sort of comically menacing creatures. Yes. Now, it's rare that you see that comical, menacing appearance in one figure, but right there on the cover of this Caldecott Medal-winning book, you've got a funny, menacing creature.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you get to have more than one feeling at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, the wild things are somewhat menacing, ogre-like, but they're also kind of goofy, you know? They have those eyes that sort of pop out, and you know you're not supposed to be too frightened by them. But kids love to be a little bit frightened. You know, that's it's a big part of growing up to see that you can withstand that
and
be the master of it.
He actually deals with fright in two senses. There's the scary things from your nightmares and your dreams, but also there's separation. Being up in a room alone in the dark is scary for if kids are young enough, and is part of the problem with very young kids being sent to their room alone at night. And that too gets kind of detoxified with the fact that there's hot supper there.
Yeah, when he gets back.
It's not so bad when he's really back and he's there.
But he is a mischievous little boy. He's got on this suit with a long tail. It's white. He's got these ears pointing out, and it's a wolf suit. And the first page reads, "The night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another, chasing the dog. His mother called him Wild Thing. And Max said, 'I'll eat you up.' So he was sent to bed without eating anything." There were some people who had problems with his being sent to bed without supper, Greg.
I was not one of them, although since I was raised in an extremely strict Catholic household, I confess the only part of the story that gave me pause when I was a kid was the fact that his supper was waiting for him.
If he was
sent to bed without his supper, then the consistency of parental control meant he should not have had his supper. And I was way old before I came around to warm up to the love that represented, the deeper love that overcame the requirement for regulation in the household.
Extraordinary, Judith. You find some anti-guilt, anti-anxiety in this story.
Yes, absolutely. And as far as I'm too much of a professional to give an opinion, because I would have to say, because of my background, it would depend on the context. If this was a child, a timid, inhibited child, you might be hugging them and congratulating them. It really depends on the context.
Well, look, Judith, when you come back down to it, if he really made so much mischief that was really, really deserving of not getting his supper, his wolf suit would have been a lot dirtier. It's still white, as Diane points out.
You know, it's interesting that Bruno Bettelheim thought that the book might be too much for a small child to be have that read to before going to bed. Do you think?
Well, I don't think he even thought that, really. He wrote that in his column in Ladies' Home Journal a number of years after the book came out. And then a few years after that, he published his book, The Uses of Enchantment, which was really about fairy tales. But he criticized modern children's literature for not being upfront enough about the strongest feelings that kids have. And here was a book that had already come along, Where the Wild Things Are, which did just that. So I think when Bettelheim was speaking from his better side, his more enlightened side, he really understood that a book like Where the Wild Things Are does have a place in a child's life.
You see this as a book of power, a child with power. Mm-hmm. How so?
Well, Max is this little guy, as all children are, but he isn't cowering. He's looking right in the eyes of the wild things. And he is not being thrown by a bad situation. You know, the parents or his mother is saying, you know, I'm in charge here. And he's not being defeated by that. He's going off and finding another way of looking at things.
Judith.
in discussing this book a couple of days ago at lunch with two other child psychiatrists at work, and I asked them their opinion, and two of us felt that the acceptance of rage and control was the dominant, but the third person said, no, this is about empowerment. And that was her take on it, actually.
The child somehow taking control of this situation, Craig.
Well, and again, I'm now thinking about how we read it at home. And I sometimes read it, and my kid's other dad reads it. And when he reads it to them, he always adds music to the wild rumpus. He rolls his knees up and down so the kids can bounce, and he goes, dun, 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 for one page. And then he has different rhythm on the second page of the three-page quiet Ryle rumpus. And then a third meter for the third page. And in watching how the kids love that, how they enter into the beat and rumpus on his lap with Max and the wild things, it makes me remember one of the reasons I love the book so much and why, for me, it's a sort of totemic piece. It's about the making of art, among other things, because I think when Max goes and gets to the stage of the wild rumpus, he has done everything he needs to do, and he is creating, he is dancing, and he is making something, and he is larger when he comes back because of it.
Gregory Maguire, his new book is titled Making Mischief, A Maury Sendak Appreciation. And, of course, we're talking about Maury Sendak's book, Where the Wild Things Are. And when we come back, we'll take some of your calls, 800-433-8850. And welcome back to our September Readers Review. This month we're talking about looking at Maurice Sendak's absolutely delightful and indeed thrilling book, Where the Wild Things Are. It did win the Caldecott Medal, even after much controversy and much talk about what this book represented, whether it was indeed an appropriate book for children. He clearly won out. It would seem that people just fell in love with this book. Here's a message from Facebook. Paula says, I love his stories, especially In the Night Kitchen. His artwork and stories are mesmerizing to me. His life story is amazing as well. Gregory, you might talk about that life story.
Well, I've known Maurice as a friend for about 30 years, but he is a famously private man, and I did not know a lot about the larger context of his life until fairly recently when he's become more public about it. It seems that as he was growing up safe and warm, if in a not particularly prosperous household in Brooklyn, his cousins in Eastern Europe were beginning to suffer what would befall so many in the 30s and into the 40s. So I think he has pointed to the fact that much of the motivation of his long career in making art has been a way of dealing with the triumph of living against a background screed of all the death and destruction and terror that happened while he was growing up happy and safe in Brooklyn.
Do you see that playing out in this book, Where the Wild Things Are?
Not so much in this book, but I think there are other visual references as covered, I think, in Gregory's book, some of the references to very much to Jewish shtetls and persecution.
And let's open the phones and invite our callers into the conversation, 800-433-8850, to our September Reader's Review of Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. Good morning, Annie. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had the privilege of working with Mr. Sendak at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia, where all of his papers and drawings are stored. And a story that he told us that I really love is that the last line of the book is, "And it was still hot," meaning his supper. And the publishers at the last minute wanted to change this line to, "And it was still warm." And he really had to dig in his heels and say, "You know, you're kind of missing the point, so hot," you know. But evidently they thought, well, children will burn their tongues and it will be a disaster. So I just thought that was great. And you have to fight for what you believe in.
You bet. Annie, how long did you work with Maurice Sendak?
I was there for 3 years, and he was in and out. You know, he wasn't there full time.
Sure.
A lovely, lovely man.
You're absolutely right. I had the privilege of interviewing Maurice Sendak twice, and it could not have been a more wonderful experience. Thanks for calling, Annie. Let's go now to Cincinnati, Ohio, to Carlton. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
I just had a comment. One of your panelists mentioned earlier about the way that you felt you were able to feel at one time kind of, you know, this fright or terror almost, and at the same time, the sense of excitement while reading the book. And that's my memory of reading it as a kid. I was a little younger. My brother's 2 years older, and because of that, I think I was a little younger when we read the book for the first time. But I remember being kind of scared of it in the same way as, like, an Alice in Wonderland type thing. But it's one of those books that stuck with me. My brother and I requested that our parents buy us pajama pants like the little boys that we could dress up like him. So it stuck with us to this day.
That's great. Go ahead.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the things that a book or any, well, children start off with feelings that have no shape, you know, and when they're very young, they don't have the words for those feelings either. And one of the things that a picture book like Where the Wild Things Are can do is to give a shape to those big experiences that are sort of rolling around inside them.
Greg.
I also think that Maurice is smart enough in this book, as in really all his work, to give the young reader, the reader who is inexperienced with life and with his or her own feelings, the cues to know how this is going to go. You talked at the beginning, Diane, about the wild thing on the cover and about the fact that there was something both ominous but also cuddly. Notice the wild thing on the cover has his eyes closed. He's asleep, waiting for the adventure to happen. When the eyes open, when you're in the middle of the book, you see that the eyes are huge. They're disproportionately large for the head, and this is what babies' eyes are. I'm not the psychologist among us, but I've always heard it said that one of the reasons that we love and feel warm about small animals and about babies is that proportionally their eyes are big in their heads, and that makes them lovable. So Sendak has made these creatures lovable. Using cues that even children can understand.
And they smile. I mean, and they bow down to him.
They let him be king.
That's right. These huge creatures.
Right. They don't call for a recount.
Not at all. Not at all. In fact, I must say one of the things that I've been trying to think to myself as a pretend question is, without the pictures, would there be much here? then I think the pictures so create more than the words that while the theme, of course, is this major, complex, universal theme of handling emotions of all sorts, but without the pictures, it would really be flat.
Well, and of course, it's going to go one step further as we're about to see this brand new movie based on this book. Has he participated, has Maurice participated in the making of the movie?
As I understand it, it is his permission and his friendship with the director, Spike Jonze, that allowed the project finally to go forward. I don't know to the extent that he has been involved in a day-by-day decision. I know he doesn't travel very much.
I've seen the trailer of this movie, and it's perfectly delightful. Jonathan Smith tells me that Maurice worked closely with the director on the story and the costumes. So I can't imagine what these costumes are going to look like. It's really something. Carlton, thanks for calling. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. Thank you, Diane.
Surely.
I just wanted to comment on a bit of a dilemma I have with the movie coming out. The book was a personal favorite of mine as a kid, but now that I'm 22, I see the trailer come out, and I'm really excited about it. But unfortunately, none of my friends want to see the movie, being that it's a kid's movie.
You have to educate them.
Do you think that those same qualities, the complexities, can be transferred to the screen from the book?
Could be, yeah. I mean, Chris, whenever you're making a movie from a book, you just have to remember that a movie is a different medium, you know. So it can't be just a literal translation. It has to do something that only a movie can do, but using as its starting point the story of the book.
Judith.
The timing would be, it's hard for me to envision a full-length movie. Do you know the length of it? It's as a short movie, I can easily
I think
see.
It's more than maybe an hour, hour and a half.
Really? That's a full-length movie.
Yeah. I think that the imagination plays such a huge role in this book. And when you see things on the screen, that changes the whole perspective.
Yeah. I mean, you were saying before how the words by themselves might not be that interesting. I mean, they are beautifully crafted, but the pictures stretch them out in a way and create a sense of timing.
So it could be like Fantasia.
And give you places to pause and to think and look and explore, you know. And the movie really could do the same thing, theoretically.
Here's an email from Heidi in Raleigh, North Carolina. I don't know if anyone can confirm this, but she says, Mr. Sendak once said that the faces of the wild things were actually based on people in his family. Great.
I have heard him say that he remembers the experience of his Jewish relatives coming over for Sunday lunch and coming down over the hovering children to hug them and smother them with kisses. And, oh, you're so juicy, I could eat you up. If not the exact transliteration of their affectionate greetings, at least certainly the mood and feeling of cologne-ridden oppression that big adults bring to children.
Leonard, what did the Caldecott Medal mean for Maurice?
Well, it's a validation in the larger world. It put him on a very big stage and gave him, I think, the freedom to continue what he was already doing, but without the worry, you know, that if he were to try something different or a little bit experimental, that that people wouldn't give it a second look. You know, it's a validating experience for all illustrators.
I should say.
And I think he made the most of it because he was very prolific as a essayist and giver of lectures and speeches.
All right, to Erin in Rockford, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Morning. Thanks, Diane.
Sure.
I wanted to comment about an interview that I remember reading with Maurice Sendak several years ago where he spoke about the controversy that swirled around the book and the idea that it would frighten children. And his response to that was, well, childhood is frightening, which, I, you know, there are so many things that happen as a child that are so different, the way that you perceive things, from what adults see. So I'm, you know, and as a parent now looking at the book, I remember reading it as a child and kind of climbing inside the illustrations in my imagination. And it was such a huge impact on me, this and In the Night Kitchen were two of my very, very favorite books growing up. And I just see the wild things as just the wild children inside of Max's imagination.
And how about
the different sides of his own nature.
And how about inside of yours?
My children?
No, yourself.
Oh, my own?
Yes.
Yeah, I definitely very much felt Max's presence growing up. When I was in high school, took a wall in my bedroom and redrew one of the panels from The Wild Rumpus, where Max is swinging from the tree, because it just so captured childhood to me and just embracing the wild nature of childhood. But then, you know, coming home to a hot meal and the acceptance that the wild things have their place in your life.
Of course, Greg.
I have several dozen wild things who live in me all the time. I wish they paid rent. I think that it is it's a wonderful chance to remember that in this book, in Where the Wild Things Are, and also in The Night Kitchen, which is a companion of sorts, that there are no parents. There is the effect of the parent, but the parent is not pictured. The parent is not drawn. It's a little bit like the Peanuts comic strip.
Right.
The parents are off stage, which allows the child really to be center stage in a sense, in a way that he only is in his ego, but never is in the real adult world.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And he was identifying the child as the underdog, but someone who comes out victorious, Judith.
Well, it's really a symphony of happenings. And what's so wonderful is the way it's all right. And there's Max glorying in power and getting to be king of the wild things, even terrorizing them. And yet at the end, it all turns out all right, and he doesn't feel alone, and there's this hot supper, and the wild things are sorry to see him go, so he had it both ways. He terrorized, he was their ruler, and they're grieving that he's leaving. He's got it all, and it all turns out fine. And that is the psychological measure, that there. Freud says there's no oars in the unconscious, there's only ands.
He even has a private boat.
Let's go to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Judith.
Hello, Diane.
Hi.
Hi. I love reading to my children, and I have two sons who are 10 years apart in age, and they were both terrified of Where the Wild Things Are, and to the point where I had to take the book physically out of their bedrooms and put it elsewhere. So,
wow.
Yeah, I was...
How old were they when you began to read it to them?
Probably between 4 and 6.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, you did the right thing. Children will tell you what they're ready for, and when they're ready for it, they'll come and say, "Where was that book we used to have?" And they know. I had nephews and nieces who had the same experience with Sendak's extremely complicated and heartbreaking picture book called Outside Over There. I had a nephew who hid it in the car underneath his car seat so that I wouldn't read it to him again. And once I realized what he had done, I said, that's fine. That's your prerogative.
Yeah.
I am here to serve you with what you tell me you need, not the
Whereas,
other way around.
Whereas, on the other hand, our son was 3 years old when the book came out. He adored it and wanted it read to him over and over over again. And each time would see something new in these drawings.
Mm-hmm. I once heard Maurice say that he would rather see a child throw a copy of his book across the room than be forced to read it if he didn't really want to.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So right on, Judith, right on. Thanks for calling. I wonder who some of Maurice Sendak's influences were, Gregory.
Well, I've been considering that a great deal in the last 10 years or so, and one person I've heard him referred to in print is the German storyteller Wilhelm Busch. He has a collection of adventures about Max und Moritz, two rapscallion boys who get in all kinds of trouble. And there's one of them named Max. One of the adventures that they have is quite similar to the plot line of In the Night Kitchen. They are full of brio and full of sort of nerve and energy, and they love to confound the adult world. And they make mischief right, left, and center. So I think that any artist will dip the bucket wherever he or she can find a pool and pull up something from here, something from there, something from memory, something from something they read, something from poetry, something from experience, and put it together into a new work. Only a real artist can put it together, though.
And we're talking about the artist and writer Maurice Sendak, our September Reader's Review, Where the Wild Things Are. I look forward to talking with you after the break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Nick Hornby's new novel, Juliet Naked, like his novel High Fidelity, is full of music-obsessed characters. But this time, it's not just the fan's vantage point he's writing from, but also the fan's girlfriend and the musician he's obsessed with. On the next Fresh Air, Hornby talks about his new novel and his screenplay for the new film In Education, set in post-war pre-rock England. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to our September Reader's Review, the book Where the Wild Things Are, with stories and pictures by Maurice Sendak. We have an email here from Leah in Washington, D.C. She says, I bought Where the Wild Things Are for my 3-year-old niece who is battling cancer. She obviously has a different grasp of fear, and I was a little worried the book would add fear that she didn't need. But I loved the book, so I gave it to her with the hope it would provide an escape. And as your guest mentioned, that sense of empowerment. Could your child psychiatrist comment on books such as this one as a release for children going through traumatic experiences? Judith.
Well, the question raises several issues, and I think one has to do with age. 3 is an age where it's hard to predict, and as we were discussing earlier, the only answer is going to be from the child and his or her reaction. But I think that any sense of power and strength would have to be generally good, What would get more complicated would be for a specific kind of illness. Again, what kind of strength would be most empowering, something more related to what she's going through immediately or more general? I don't really see, if the child doesn't get scared by the book, it's certainly going to do any harm.
And I would think just the act of giving a book to a child from someone who obviously loves that child would mean a great deal in and of itself, you know, and would mitigate any fearful reaction that the child might have otherwise.
Well, especially if the parent gives the book with a message, this is something I love. Maybe you will love it, maybe you won't, but I love it.
Yes, exactly.
One point in keeping with what Leonard just said, that I know numerous people who in childhood were converted to being readers at any level of book because of their illness, and then that stayed with them.
Well, I certainly hope for her niece that the book is a pleasure. That's the point. And here's another email from Julia, who says, I used to have my kindergarten students act this out while I read the story. They were all wild things, except the one who was Max, who was in control of the wild things and could quiet them by raising his hand. They loved it. Isn't that great?
I think we should have a national Wild Thing Day where we all had a wild rumpus and got it out of our systems, and then somebody could lower their hand, the kindergarten leader.
I fully agree. All right, let's go to Michelle in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to say, I'm going to tell my age. I'm 37. I have three kids under five, and we all love Mari Sendak. And I'm so glad that I had them, because I got to read his works again. As a child, my favorite was Pierre. And my kids, they love Where the Wild Things Are, and they, when we read it, they pretend they're howling at the moon, and they have a march around the room. He's just a timeless classic, and I'm so thankful for him.
So glad you called. Thanks, Michelle. Any comments, Leonard?
Well, I think you can tell a book is working when children feel like taking part and sort of collaborating with the author on some level, and dancing. There are places in Where the Wild Things Are where you're pretty much, invited to shout out along with Max and put on a play, even make a movie. It's all a way of being involved with it.
Let's go now to Charlie in Wichita, Kansas. Good morning. You're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. A few years ago, it strikes me he was about 73 at the time. He was giving an interview on NPR, and he explained that the original title for the book was Where the Wild Horses Are, but it turns out, he said, I can't really draw horses. So his editor says, well, we like the concept, what can you draw? So he scriggled out one of these caricatures, and they says, where on earth did that come from? And he said, those are my Eastern European relatives of my childhood. I just thought that was very fascinating.
Greg?
Well, that points to the significance in the life of any artist of a really good editor. I do remember, I think, in the Selma Lane's book, The Art of Mari Sendak, a story being told that in an early draft of this book, the bad things, the mischievous things that Max had done included, I think, dialing long distance, which was, I think, rightly edited out, whited out as being too specific and something that would keep the book from reaching a national and an international audience, not just then, but in time. And I think that was a very sage editor.
Talk about the time flow of this book, which I think is really fascinating.
Within the story?
Yeah.
It's all kind of a blur. It's like very much like a dream. Time kind of runs together. It turns out at the end that not much time has really passed at all. But it could be years. So much happens. In the way that in a child's life, an hour can be full of a tremendous amount of imaginary experience.
An hour can be so long, mm-hmm. and yet mm-hmm. his dinner is still hot mm-hmm. when he returns.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Barbara, who's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. It's so good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Listening to this program prompted me to go over to the bookshelf of the children's books that I have not yet passed on to my daughters, who are now 46 and 44. I have one of the first Scholastic book edition, and it just takes me back. My daughters loved this book, and my older daughter particularly, because she has always wanted to tame the wild things in life. She's still doing that. She's working to, you know, to change the world in so many good ways. And this book allowed so much freedom to, you know, just be out there unafraid, and to even let this child know that, you know, you can befriend these other wild things in the world and bring them into control a little bit, and you can send them home after you've had the rumpus, which of course is what I think we need more of today. But anyway, I thank you for this show, and I never miss the Reader's Review.
Oh, good, Barbara. And like you, we have a first edition of Where the Wild Things Are, because when we moved and had to get rid of all these books, we
yes.
could not get rid of this one. So I'm so happy. Thanks for calling. Here's an email which says Where the Wild Things Are is the best children's picture book ever written. I worry, however, about turning a 48-page book into a full-length movie. It's likely to lose its magical qualities, not to mention the book's complexity and depth. It is important that Maurice Sendak chose Spike Jonze to do this movie. What will he bring to it?
Well, he is a person of an enormously intellectual and deeply subconscious-driven energy. So I suspect that the thing to remember for all of us, including for me, who's going to go see the film as soon as I can,
me too.
Is that the movie exists here and the book exists there. And there's no way, however fine a movie it is, and I sure hope it's good, there's no way that the movie will displace the book from all the shelves that we're talking about. There's one advantage the book has and why the book can never be displaced by a film, and that is that the child looking at the book, or even the adult going back and remembering it, decides the pacing and timing of the turning of the page in absolutely crisp, individualized sequence. When a child is ready to turn the page, then the child turns the pages. However fine a film is, it's done at the rate of the producer.
It's right. Interesting. We're told that Maurice Sendak told Spike Jonze to make the movie that Spike wants rather than to try to just remake the book.
Right, and a book and a movie will never fit in a parent's lap, you know. So that intimate experience of reading the book to a child is going to keep going on.
Number of callers are asking you all to compare Where the Wild Things Are to the other great favorite of Sendak's, In the Night Kitchen, about which, I mean, talk about controversy over this little boy's genitals that were exposed in The Night Kitchen. Judith.
As I understand it, the controversy arose at the library level, and that the editors were all right with it. Obviously, the author was all right with it. And so the question is, how much of this came from the librarians, or were there parent protests, and so on? But we're really off Sendak now and on to... librarians?
But
we're not off Sendak, because Sendak drew that image.
Right.
Yeah. He wanted that image to be precisely that way.
I think what is fair to say is the big contrast is that here, where the wild things are, it's clearly about rage, it's clearly about power and about fear, but I don't think sex comes into it here, whereas in the Night Kitchen you could bring it up, and that would be the...
Yeah. The notorious case in the Night Kitchen was in Louisiana, where some librarians were either painting over Mickey's penis or ripping the page out or pasting a little fig leaf, something like that. And it got to the point where his editor at Harper, Ursula Nordstrom, sent out a public letter to the whole book community, publishers, librarians, teachers, everyone, essentially defending his right as an artist to express himself in the way that he thought most appropriate, and she standing behind him as someone who believed in his talent.
All right, put aside the controversy, though. How do you compare, contrast In the Night Kitchen with Where the Wild Things Are?
Well, the comparisons are clearly that both are mythic voyages into the subconscious. One is a voyage into, you might say, rage or the rural aspect of rage, and the other is the urban aspect of comfort, sensuality, the smell of things baking, and the feel of
soft dough.
And swimming and all the things that affect the body of the young as they affect the body of the elderly. Wonderful celebration of the senses. But they are parallel arcs. In both books, the child protagonist leaves a warm, safe environment and in the last page returns triumphant and safe and larger than when he left.
All right. Let's go to Ellen. No, sorry, to Gigi. Here in Washington, D.C., at 7 minutes before the hour. Gigi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just wanted to recount very quickly my experience as well as a child. My brother and I lived homeless with my mother in San Francisco until I was about 4 or 5. And when my father got custody of us, The Wild Things, that book was the only book that really brought us solace because we really didn't feel like we fit in, and in fact, we were very dysfunctional children, and it was a book that we read every night, and my dad would sing the song The Wild Thing, or Wild Things, rather, alongside the bed, you know, to get us to go to sleep at night, and it just kind of, I've carried it with me in that experience and that feeling of not having to fit in, because that's okay, and having a different experience as a child is okay, too, and in fact, I was given a grant in honor of my mother as an adult to paint a mural for children in San Francisco, and I painted a mural which was based on The Wild Things. And I just wanted to say that it's that book, you know, resonates for so many people, and for me it's been a sense of healing just kind of all throughout my life.
I'm so glad you called, Gigi. Thank you. Judith?
Just to say that's a wonderful story, and
it
you truly were
is.
Empowered by
wow.
it. I hope Maurice Sendak knows of this story.
I think we're going to send Maurice a CD. This program, we tried to reach him. He's out of pocket until about 1 o'clock. Let's go to Zionsville, Indiana. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you very much. I feel so lucky. I wanted to say I have 3 wild things. One of them is Max, and I love the book, and I remember it every time we're at the dinner table and they have to leave the table before bad manners or what have you. And I think about that book every time because I do want them to have some dinner at the end of the day. But my little Max was the wild thing last year for Halloween. And I thought it was so creative that we made this costume for Max to be the wild thing for Halloween. And it turns out there was another boy in the neighborhood who dressed up in the same costume. So you had 2 Max the Wild Things for Halloween last year. Only mine was the only one whose name was Max. But I love the book.
That's terrific. Thank you, Ellen, for sharing that. And let's see, one final email from Jennifer, who's in Bethesda, Maryland. She says, I may be reading too much into it, but when I read it to my girls, I thought Max was playing out the fantasy of being all grown up with the wild things and that he retreats back to the warmth of childhood where he is loved most of all at the end. Being a king may be nice, but being a little boy nurtured by his mother's warm food in his room is pretty good, too.
Makes sense to me.
Makes sense to me, too. The book we've been talking about, and if you haven't had a chance to read it, I certainly recommend it. Where the Wild Things Are, Stories and Pictures by Marie Sendak. Dr. Judith Rapoport is a child psychiatrist. Gregory McGuire is the author of Making Mischief, a Marie Sendak Appreciation. Leonard Marcus is the author of numerous books on children's literature. Thank you all so much. I love this program.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to do a wild roar right now.
Oh, good. Excellent. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.